what's going on. This is the Voice of the Nets podcast. I'm Chris Carino, Fordham University class of 1992. You know, I got to call the NCAA tournament as a student broadcaster in 1992, not knowing that the Fordham University basketball team would not get back to the NCAA tournament. They have still not played an NCAA tournament game since I called that game back in 1992. But things are starting to look up for the Fordham Rams. In fact, this season, they have won 24 games. It's the most games they've won since my junior year, the 1990-91 team that, by the way, won the Patriot League title, but because it was the first year of the league, did not have an automatic bid. So they had to play a play-in game against the winner of the Northeast Conference and had to go on the road to Laredo, Pennsylvania and play St. Francis. And they lost that game. They were favorites, but they lost and end up having to settle for the NIT. But I am a proud Fordham alum, and it is a basketball school. And this year, the basketball team has energized the Rose Hill campus up in the Bronx. The historic Rose Hill gym has been sold out night in and night out. And Keith Ergo, their head coach, is mostly responsible, and he'll give all the credit to his players and his staff, of course, but he has fired up the fan base, the alumni, the students. He's getting them to show up. And this week, we hope everybody will show up at Barclays Center as the A-10 tournament takes over Barclays Center. And we're going to talk with Keith Ergo. He's got a really interesting story, some great stuff on how he became a coach, things that happen in your life that transform your story, and what makes him laugh, cry, think, all that stuff. And we'll get to Keith Ergo in a minute. But of course, just a couple of minutes here on the Nets. And they're heading out on a five-game road trip right now because the A-10 tournament is taking over Barclays Center as we begin the March Madness. The Nets have to clear out of town and go out on the road. As we release this tonight, they'll be in Houston to start this five-game road trip. They're going on the road trip having won two games in a row. That was after losing four straight. The game that really has turned things around for this team, we'll see how far it extends, how much they've been able to turn it around, was at TD Garden in Boston. And the Nets found themselves down by 28 points in the first half of the game. A Net team that had lost four straight games was coming off a loss at Madison Square Garden where they got thoroughly handled by the Knicks. And I think it's the team was starting to doubt itself a little bit. And you've got all these new players, and there's been four new guys in the starting lineup when you look at Dinwiddie, Finney-Smith, Cam Johnson, and Mikal Bridges starting alongside Nick Claxton. When you look at that group, it's supposed to be a top-level defensive group. You've got five excellent individual defenders. And you thought that if this team was going to struggle, maybe it'd be on the offensive end. But there's no excuse for this group to struggle the way they've struggled on the defensive end of the floor. And before that game in Boston, I do my pregame interview with Jacques Vaughn, and I asked him, because I had it in my mind, and I had a reference that I wanted to see if he was going to reference the same thing. I asked him, at what point do you think this group looked the best? And he answered that first game they all played together, the home game against the Philadelphia 76ers, where I think the Sixers did end up getting to 100, but the Nets, you know, couldn't score down the stretch. Sixers came back, won that game. But the Nets played an outstanding defensive game against a good offensive team. And Jacques referenced the fact that because it's the first time they were all together, They didn't put any real schemes in there. They just said, everybody just go out there and just play instinctively on the defensive end. Since that time, they tried to scheme the way they want to do things. And there have been times they're putting Nick Claxton a little bit more drop, and they've got to try to change the way they switch and don't switch everything because you sometimes have the matchups you want. And what ends up happening is you've got guys who were on the previous net team, guys who are on Dallas, guys who are on Phoenix. They're all speaking different languages defensively. Their instincts are a little different. The principles are a little different. And this team was getting torched offensively. Teams were torching them. And it almost hit rock bottom in the game in Boston. They're down by 28 points. It's 51-23. And Jacques Bond just said, listen, forget it. Let's just go out there now, switch everything, play instinctively, and just go at it defensively like I know you can. Stop thinking about it and just go defend. And the Nets ended up allowing just 41 points in the second half to the Celtics, forced 12 second half turnovers, came back and won that game. First team in the NBA this year to come back from as many as 28 down to win a game. Matched the franchise record, done a couple of other times. And then they compound that, go out on Sunday against the Charlotte Hornets, held the Hornets to 41 points in the second half, held them to 86 points in the game. And we'll see if this will continue, this trend. And yes, you would love to be able to put in some schemes that you feel would fit this team and the personnel the best and optimize your level of winning. But sometimes, you know, you don't, it's not the beginning of the year. You don't have a training camp. You don't have preseason games. You don't have time to kind of find out who you are. You're under 20 games to go. You're fighting for a playoff spot. Perfect is the enemy of good. It's not going to be perfect right now. But find out the way it can be best. And after that game in Boston, Jacques Vaughn said, you know, we finally just said, let's just get back to basics. Let's keep it simple. And let's do simple better. Jacques Vaughn has used that term a lot since taking over. Try to simplify things. Do simple better. This team had to just get back to playing instinctively. They've got a lot of really good individual defensive players. And that defense can then spark their offense. They play at a high pace. When they get that pace going, when they defend, get stops, they can get out and run and move. And, you know, it's like, it reminds me of the movie Seabiscuit. Everybody remember Seabiscuit? Right? Great movie about the horse. And Chris Cooper played the trainer. And they had bought the horse, right? And he had been kind of a training horse. They saw something in him, right? There was a little feistiness in him. They liked him. There was a competitive streak. And they really saw something in him. They buy him. And now they got to train him. And he's kind of disappointing as he's running around. They're timing him, doing his laps, and he's disappointing. And Chris Cooper said, we got to get this horse out and just let him run. Because he goes, sometimes this horse has been running around in circles so long, he forgot what he is. He goes, and sometimes a horse has just got to learn to be a horse again. Remember, he has Tobey Maguire just go out and ride him in the woods, and Seabiscuit kind of gets his swagger back. He remembers to be a horse again, just go out there and run, turn everything around for him. So maybe that day, that night in Boston, when the Nets turned a 28-point deficit into a 10-point win, perhaps that's where these Net defenders, like hard-playing competitive guys like Dorian Finney-Smith, Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson, Spencer Dinwiddie, Nick Claxton, they learned again to be who they are. Even in that game, down the stretch, they closed it out offensively by just finding the weak link. In this case, in Boston, it was Al Horford, and just attacking him. Spencer Dinwiddie said after the game, told us in an interview, you know, we went big game hunting. We just went hunting. Simple. Do simple better. It's very simple for the Fordham Rams this week in the Atlantic 10 tournament. They have the double bye. They're the 3 seed. So they go right to the quarterfinals. And if they can win three games, they win the A-10 tournament, and they will be in the NCAA tournament for the first time since 1992. Now, it's not going to be easy. VCU is the one seed, Dayton, number two, the two seed, probably a one seed league, a one bid league. See, probably the winner of the tournament is going to go to the NCAA tournament. So Fordham, they believe because of Keith Urgo. He has energized that campus, as we mentioned. And he's obviously you can imagine a busy week for Keith Urgo with the A-10 tournament coming up at Barclays Center. He was kind enough to give us a good chunk of his time, but we wanted to carve out a spot for him. So on his commute to the Rose Hill campus in the Bronx, we were able to chat with Keith Urgo while he was driving, which, as you're going to find out here in this interview, there have been some transformative times in Keith Urgo's life that have happened while he was driving or because he was driving. So stay tuned for that and what makes him laugh, cry, think, and some very poignant stuff from the head coach of the Fordham Rams, the talk of the A-10 as they get ready for the tournament at Barclays Center. And we want to see everybody show up at Barclays Center this week, make this a home court advantage for the Rams in Brooklyn this week. Here on the Voice of the Nets, the head coach of the Fordham Rams, and then stay tuned for a little postgame. Here's Keith Urgo. Keith Urgo, I was courtside for your last home game there at Rose Thrill, as they're calling it now, the Rose Hill campus at Fordham. And, I've done a lot of things in my broadcasting career that could impress my son, who's a freshman at Fordham, and just to feel that the pulse I have of the campus right now. You walked over to me right before the start of the festivities to say hello. And I don't like to generally bother coaches and players right before it all starts, but you kind of saw me, you walked over across the baseline, said hello. Of all the things I've done in my career, I don't know if my son was ever more impressed than at that moment, as the kids would say, call a little flex, that you came over to say hi to me. That's how much of a kind of a rock star you are on campus right now.
I don't know about that part. I think it has to do with that. I know it was more of a flex for me to be able to walk over and shake your hand, quite honestly, for most people out there who know all you've done and what you meant to Fordham and what you've meant to New York sports. And so I just, it was a flex for me, and I'll make sure your son knows that. But the energy on campus right now is fantastic. It's something that, honestly, it's why you want to get into college athletics. You want that incredible community. The environment right now, Rose Thrill and the Shirtless Herd. And when we took the job at Fordham, we wanted to try to create something that was going to last a long time, not just a one-hit wonder. And in order to do that, you need everybody. You need the entire community, specifically the student body, to be engaged, or else it's not going to work. And they've jumped on board. They've embraced me. They've embraced my family. They've embraced our staff and obviously our players. And our players are absolutely loving it. Hmm. They like getting out into the community on campus right now. There's a lot to be thankful for. So we're going to try to ride the wave as much as possible. But we wanted to be something. We wanted to create some traditions in Rose Thrill.
Yeah.
We want, the freshman student body to have something now forever, kind of propel us to what we think can be just an incredible home court advantage for years to come. And the only way you're going to get something sustainable is to create that environment that's not just this one season, but continues to take place from now until hopefully a long time from now.
Yeah, they've got they wear the ergonomics t-shirts. They chant your name. It's funny. I when I was bringing my son to visit the campus a couple of years ago, Eddie Cull, your great athletic director, who we'll talk about in a minute here. He, not a not one of those ivory tower athletic directors. He's a guy that's right down there in the trenches with you, right? We love Eddie Call.
Absolutely. So I
told him I was going to be there, and I bring my son around, and Eddie brought out a lot of the a bunch of the young guys from your staff a couple of years ago, and they were kind of asking me, because I was there in the late 80s, early 90s, and the 90, especially my junior year, that 90-91 team, I was a student broadcaster. They won more games than any Fordham team had won until this one. And the next year went to the tournament. And so the young guys on the staff were asking me, well, you know, what was the gym like back then? You know, did you get the campus come that were the crowds? And I said, you know what? I was so fortunate those 4 years I was there. That gym, you used to have to shoehorn people into that gym. And they were in the MAC. And when you play teams like Iona, Manhattan, you know, the Big East teams used to come in there. St. John's, Seton Hall would come in. And we used to beat them every year I was there. And they stopped coming because that's how it was. They were like, we're not going there to play. And I said, if you guys could start to win, it can get like this again. They are longing to pack that gym. And I think you're finally seeing that again this year.
I mean, it's look, for years and years, they've said, regardless of whether or not they're fans, crazed fans or not, it's a very difficult place to play regardless.
Yeah.
It's loud no matter how many folks are in there. You know, we had some opportunities to play certain teams. Nobody, you know, it's difficult right now to schedule out a conference regardless because just high majors, you know, almost every high major team, their season right off the bat has 20 games in league. You know, when you're talking ACC, Big East, Big 10, Big 12, or anything, you know, so, and then most of them have an MTE that gets up to 23, and then they have one or two one-off games because of their league, like the Big Ten ACC Challenge, whatever. And by the time they get to their non-conference scheduling, they got about five or six games they got to fill. They want nothing to do with Fordham or any other Atlantic 10 team, and they definitely don't want to do a home-and-home and come into our building.
Yeah,
you know, Danny Hurley said it, you know, when he was at Rhode Island, he struggled when they played Fordham because, you know, the gym is so difficult to play at regardless. So, you know, it's very difficult to get anybody to come and play there because they know without anybody in the gym, it's difficult. With the fans, it's amazing. And, you know, we had some big-time coaches come in there. Travis Ford, Frank Martin, Mark Schmidt, all these guys, Archie Miller. I mean, Archie Miller, Alumni Hall, I was at Penn State for 10 years. I played there every year. I was an assistant or associate head coach at Penn State. And I'm telling you, you know, the Alumni Hall is incredible, right? Yeah. It's one of the loudest places in America. He flat out said, this is as good of a college environment as I've ever been a part of. And when you have opposing teams like that, opposing coaches that have played in huge arenas, big-time programs, talking about the advantage we have in that building, I mean, it's evident. You know, it's pretty powerful. And I think you saw, honestly, the other night was as loud as it's been since I've been here, for sure. We've had some great crowds, but the other night was... it was electric. It was electric. And when our team starts playing as well as they played the other night, it's tough to stop.
Absolutely. And, let's go back here another year. So you came in as an associate head coach with Kyle Neptune, and the program was in a dark place there. The basketball program was not doing well. And Kyle Neptune came in and energized things, and you got to 500. And that's where it kind of started. That was the ramp up to this year. But if people listen to this program, they know, I think almost every week I bring up this stoic philosophy and the title of the great Ryan Holiday book, The Obstacle is the Way. It's a kind of a philosophy that I live in my life. You know, you go through these challenges and sometimes you think it's the end of the world, but it can be the way through. And I'll tell you right now, the fan base was excited. The alumni were excited last year. You guys win two A-10 tournament games, get to the quarterfinals, you're 500. The juice is starting to flow. We're getting behind Kyle Neptune. And I remember this now. I'm up in Boston for game two of the Nets-Celtics series in the playoffs last year. And I'm just about to get on the air. And I had my son doing stats. He was sitting next to me. And I get the Woj notification on my phone. that all us NBA guys, we're glued to the Woj notifications. And it said, Jay Wright is stepping down at Villanova. And immediately my mind went, no, don't say it. And then I look and it said, expected now Kyle Neptune to take over at Villanova. And I turn, I show it to my son. And like, we're literally going on the air at that point. It bummed me out, put me in such like a bad mood at that moment. And, you know, you're thinking right there, all right, this is the worst thing that could happen. But the obstacle is the way. And it took a little doing, but you stuck around. And now you're where you are right now. At that moment, what were you thinking when Kyle Neptune decided to go back to Villanova?
Well, first of all, I mean, how cool is it that your son's next to you doing stats? the obstacle is away. I mean, that is about as cool as being a father. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, it's a flex,
by the way, too. That is pretty fantastic. He doesn't get it yet, I'm sure, but he will someday.
No, he does.
How amazing that opportunity is. But yeah. I was, I'll never forget it, obviously. Myself and Ronald Ramon were down in Florida visiting our huge prize recruit, Angel Montez, who's a freshman with us now. He's a tremendous talent, wasn't able to play this year because of injury, but he'll be back soon. He's already starting to work out. He's tremendous. But we were down in Orlando, getting ready to go see him at his graduation party. And Kyle calls me, I think it was a Wednesday afternoon, and he was leaving Villanova. I didn't know he was at the time. He said, yo, you by yourself? I said, well, I'm with Ron. And he said, well, why don't you step away for a second? I said, okay. He said, listen, this has to stay between us for the next 3 hours, but it's going to get out. We have to have a team meeting in about 4 hours. I'm like, what? He goes, I just accepted the job at Villanova. I can't necessarily say on the air when I responded. I just didn't believe him. I was like, yeah. What are you talking about? Let's go. I don't have a ton of time here, Coach. He's like, no. I'm dead serious. I just accepted the job at Villanova. Jay Wright retired. And there'll be a press conference later today. We have to have a team meeting. And I'm like, wait a second. I'm like, are you? I was in shock. He said, no. We got to gather ourselves. We got to figure out, you got to get this job. And I'm like, well, obviously I need you for that. The players, things of that nature. I was like, I still didn't believe it. You hear rumblings about Jay at the Final Four and I'm around the Villanova crew. I sat, with all my Villanova former coaches and players. I was there on Saturday, in New Orleans at the game. And you hear all this stuff, but nobody ever believes anything, right? I didn't expect him to actually retire. Yeah. And I certainly didn't expect what happened to happen. So I was just kind of in shock. But then right then and there, we got into, well, let's figure out the next step. And we had a team meeting via Zoom at like 7 or 7:30 that night. And I didn't say a word. And, one of the seniors, I think it might have been Darius, stepped up. It's like, well, we want her to be the coach. And Kyle's like, listen, I don't make those calls, but if that's what you want, you guys got to, that's on you guys. And then that was that. And then next thing I knew, at about 8:30 that night, we had a Zoom with Ed Cole and the team at the time. And then, that's kind of how things started to unfold. That was Wednesday. And by Monday, I was hired as the head coach. And the reason, one of the reasons why things had to happen quickly was that May 1st deadline for the transfer portal was really kind of right time, right place for me, because some of the guys were thinking about putting their names in the portal. And then, the leadership at Fordham had to make a decision. Well, if we don't make a decision here, then we have to understand what the future could be. If we do go with Ergo, there's a good chance most of these kids will stick around. That's kind of the decision they had to make.
Unfortunately, in the college world, that's kind of what you think. That's immediately when there's a coaching change, it's not just the guy that's on the sideline making the calls. It's also you start to immediately think, well, we got all excited about these recruits that came in, who's coming in. you know, you had freshmen coming in, you had a Will Richardson, you know, just committed, and you're going, oh man, are these guys going to stay? That's where your mind goes immediately, especially in the college world today, the way it is. Guys can move around.
Yeah, and to my, fortunately, the way we do recruiting and the way we've done it all, it's always at Villanova and Penn State, here at Fordham, you know, thankfully, Kyle and I, same coaching tree, right? So the way we do recruiting is everybody's involved. Mm. So the relationships for something like this, whether or not an assistant leaves or so on and so forth, like we all have incredible relationships with our players and our recruits. And that way it's not just one guy. And if that guy's not around, then the kid's like, well, I don't have a relationship with anybody. I got to jump off. Fortunately, that's why our staff and the way we run our program is a little bit unique in that. Thankfully, I had great relationships. So did the current staff with our incoming players, as well as our current players.
Yeah. And the fact that the team went to bat, the players wanted you to come in, I would imagine that's the kind of camaraderie that started what you have this season, right? That relationship, you could tell the love that you have for them, they have for you. That's genuine, and that's what translates into 20-some-odd wins this year.
No, there's no question. Our team is as connected as any that I've been around, you know, and, you know, you have some really talented teams sometimes that just, they don't get, for whatever reason, they just don't have that connection. You know,
yeah.
They show up, they play, they leave, and they separate. And you have some talented teams that, you know, are incredibly connected, and those are really special. And then you have some teams that are just not incredibly individually talented, but they're talented enough and so connected that they have a chance to do something really special that most people don't believe. And I think we're right there in that category. And the relationships are unique. On our staff, we have incredible relationships with each other. And then, you know, that locker room is as connected as I've ever been around. And we knew the difference between last year's team and this year's team. Last year's team was more of a top-down fed organization from our coaches, Coach Neptune, our staff, down into the locker room. This year, we knew we needed some leadership within, and we've had some guys step up and hold each other accountable. And that leadership in that locker room is coming from within. Darius Quisenberry, Clint Moore, Antrell Charles, and Kyle Rose have taken it upon themselves to really push each other as well as our younger guys. And I think that's been the biggest difference. And our staff, we have incredibly wonderful people in our program. They're guys that are a little bit older, that have earned their way into the business. They're not, no disrespect to younger guys who just become GAs, but they're not just former players who just immediately got into coaching. Their life experiences, their mentorships for these kids, the relationships they've developed off the court, the bonds that they have, they're going to last the next 40 years, not the next four. And I think that is the biggest difference with this program right now is our staff and the relationships we have with each other and our players.
Keith, your connection to Fordham goes back to your father, I know. He was a Fordham alum, right? Fordham Law School alum as well. But you grew up in the D.C. area, correct? The Washington, D.C. area?
I did. I grew up in Potomac, Maryland, but I went to Gonzaga High School in Washington, D.C. Yes.
And
so my mother and father are from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
My father went to Brooklyn Prep with Joe Paterno and a lot of the greats who came to Fordham. Kenny Charles and a number of others, right? So. And then he came to Fordham to play basketball in 1954. But, you know, back then you played freshman and the academics were so intense that he couldn't continue to play.
Oh, wow.
So for him, it's a dream come true. And for me, it's a dream come true.
That's great. And I know you're one of, you've got a small family. You're one of 10 children.
Yes, sir.
Right?
I'm one of 10. I'm the eighth of 10, 9 boys and 1 girl. The first 5 children. My sister's right in the middle. They were born in Brooklyn / Pelham area.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second 5, which is all boys, is me. On the 8, were born in the D.C. metropolitan area. Now we have 30 grandchildren, at least that they know of.
Wow. It's like the old the Good Will Hunting line. Can you name them all? No, I know. I only joke.
I get it.
And one sister.
Don't ask me birthdays. Don't ask me birthday.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. But one girl out of the 10 siblings, I can't Did she did anybody that was going to date her ever come to the house at that point?
You know what? I gotta be honest with you. They were a little nervous, but you know, the guy she married fits. He almost fits too good. it's like fate. He might as well have been one of our brothers, right? But when you're, you know, it's the largest gap is 2 years between me and the one right above me. So she grew up with a guy in front and back where I could promise you all the friends were. They love to come over and hang out. Interesting.
Is that maybe where you get your competitiveness from? Just having all those brothers around, and you know the way brothers can battle each other.
Yeah, we weren't the nicest, sweetest kids in the world. I mean, we tried to be nice off the court, but you know, between us, there was never a game that actually finished. If the game was up to 11, it wasn't getting past 7. Just was what it was.
Yeah.
And there was, there were no cell phones, social media cameras. And my mother, by the time she got to the second five, it was like, if you got to her bedroom door, you might be saved. But if it was closed, if you got caught before that, you just had to take the beating, unfortunately.
The scouting report I got. So then you eventually work your way. You said Gonzaga High School there in Washington, yes. D.C. area. Were you a good player at Gonzaga?
I was okay. I was tough. You know, we had a great team. We won the Washington Catholic Athletic Conference my senior year in 1997. We beat DeMatha, who was incredibly talented. And kids like Joe Forte and Keith Bogans, two pros. Mm-hmm. And then we played in the championship. Archbishop Carroll, who had a 7-footer Boomche, who ended up Georgetown, an NBA player, but you know, we had the Gatorade Player of the Year in Alvin Brown, who ended up going to Xavier, and a number of other guys. We actually had, Rahsaan Johnson, who played at Monmouth, was Player of the Year in the conference, led Monmouth, I think in 2001, the NCAA tournament. He was the leading scorer in the conference and Player of the Year. He was on our team as well. So we had a really talented team that was very connected, similar to this team. Not as talented as other teams in our league, but so connected. So I'm very close with all of them still to this day.
Oh, wow.
We won the championship. Our staff was incredible. We had Dick Myers, who was a famous, you know, high school coach, kind of rivaled at Morgan Wooten, who I'm sure you're familiar with, mm-hmm. kind of like the Bob Hurley of the D.C. Basketball scene. And we had guys like Paul Evans, who was a former head coach at Pitt. He was on our staff. Bill Whitaker, who runs the Washington Jesuit Academy. Just a big-time high school basketball staff. All high level, could have coached college. So we had a great staff. But I was a pretty good player. I was a good point guard.
But you were not recruited to play at Fairfield, right? You ended up going to Fairfield as a basketball player. You played lacrosse, didn't you?
I did. I played basketball lacrosse at Gonzaga and then went on to Fairfield. I actually went to Fairfield to play lacrosse as my main sport, then walk on as a preferred walk on at Fairfield. As expected, and as a result, I didn't play anything for 2 years. I had to get, as a young kid, I had to learn. I learned the ropes, learned how to be a little bit more responsible.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, like you said, obstacles the way. I got in a pretty bad car accident. Mm-hmm. The end of my freshman year, it kind of woke me up a little bit, and I had to spend my sophomore year getting my life together in order to be eligible enough to play as a junior, which I did.
And your coach there, Tim O'Toole, was a GA at Fordham, I think. I want to say when I was a freshman, he come from the Fordham.
He was.
Yeah.
He was. He I played for Tim O'Toole, and he ended up, after he was the head coach at Fairfield, he came back and got his master's degree from Fordham. Hmm. He got and was also a professor teaching classes at Fordham while working on SNY, doing games before getting back in and becoming a director of operations at Syracuse, then jumping on staff at Stanford and Cal, and now he's the associate coach at Pittsburgh.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. I want to get back. But the car accident, you feel like that having to go. What was it about that experience that had an impact on you?
Well, I was getting involved in the wrong things. I was spending too much of my time with not necessarily the wrong people. I don't blame other people for my decisions, but I was just making the wrong decisions, wasn't on the right path at the time. And it just woke me up a little bit. And it made me realize the opportunities and the blessings that I had been provided up until that point. And I had some decisions to make on whether or not I wanted to get my life back together and start to do things the right way and utilize, you know, the opportunities that I was given. And so it just kind of woke me up and got me back on track and understand the value of my education at Fairfield, take advantage of it and utilize the opportunity to play sports to kind of keep me occupied so I didn't mix in with the wrong situation or crowd. And that's kind of what it was able to do for me. So I was grateful, and I had some family that, you know, I'll never forget. I'm in a hospital and I was pretty beat up. And one of my brothers came in, my brother Brian. Everybody else was telling me, you know, you're going to be okay. Everything's fine, blah, blah, blah. He came in and he gave me some really tough love. So, you know, they kind of got after me a bit. It wasn't like, oh, you doing okay? How you feeling? It was, yo, dude, you know, you better get your blanks together. You know, this is your fault. Don't look at it. No pity party. You know, you wouldn't be in here if you didn't make the wrong decision. Then you better get it together. Right. Blah, blah, blah. So the family dynamic, having some tough love, humble and hungry, really, really woke me up. So I'm grateful.
Well, luckily you have enough brothers that at least one will have that perspective for you, at that point. Yeah. Now you go through that experience. You get out of college. You don't get into coaching right away, right? I think your family is in the hotel business, right? Was that a path that you may have considered at some point?
100%. I helped. I was a part of a nonprofit organization that used sports, specifically basketball, as a means of conflict resolution. It was at the time Peace Players, or it was called Playing for Peace, but now it's Peace Players International. And I had the opportunity to go to South Africa and travel around Southern Africa with the foundation. And then I moved as soon as I graduated. That was between my junior and senior year, the summer. And then I wanted to do it again. So upon graduation, myself and four others moved to Northern Ireland. And we started the program. I lived in Dungannon, which is a little town 45 miles west of Belfast. And we used the game of basketball to bridge divide between Protestant and Catholic. I was there for a year. And when I got home, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. So I got involved in my family's business. And in high school, I had studied French. I couldn't speak it, but there's a Canadian operation within my family's company, and there were some hotels in Canada. I said, okay. And it was closer to where my wife, but my girlfriend at the time, lived in Saratoga Springs, New York. So it was perfect because it was just a short 3-hour drive from her. I said, okay, well, maybe this is my niche in the family. I'll try to continue to learn French, really dive in, and I can be kind of the Canadian, you know, liaison for Ergo Hotels. And so I moved up there and tried to. I lived in Mont-Tremblant, Canada, where my family had two hotels on a ski resort, which is beautiful. And it was incredible. And I was learning French and I was working in the hotels, but I got in another car accident. And I hit a sheet of black ice on a Saturday morning going to work, and I hit a tree and I broke some ribs and stuff. So I had to come home as a result of that accident. And when I was home, I was approached by Steve Turner, the current head coach of Gonzaga High School at the time, who asked me if I was interested in moving home and getting involved in high school basketball. And at that time, I decided to do it. So I moved back home and got some odd jobs, got my real estate license and started coaching the freshman team. And I fell head over heels in love with coaching. And that's when I made a decision, whatever I have to do to make money in order for me to keep coaching, I was going to do. So I bounced around real estate and I got involved in teaching while coaching at Gonzaga, freshman and varsity for 4 years before.
Yeah.
getting the incredible opportunity to build up.
Hopefully the next good thing that comes in your life doesn't involve another car accident. As I talk to you while you're in the car, it's a little unnerving, I hope. So now you're trying to make the transition to college. I know you can introduce to Jay Wright, who is at Villanova. Yes. And things are just starting up for him. And, it sounds like you had a great thing there, ergo hotels, and you have opportunity to have a stable life. We know going in as a video coordinator in college is not the most glamorous of jobs. Did Jay Wright try to talk you out of coaching?
Oh, 100%. I'll never forget it. You know, and back then the video internships were, it was a $10,000 internship before taxes. Mm. Now they're full paid positions for, you know, well over 50% of the program. So they're paid and you get benefits. I was 27 years old, married, just bought a house in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I moved up to Villanova and lived in Rosemont dormitory. And he said, "You really want to do this?" I said, "You don't want to do this. This isn't a life for a young guy who's trying to start a family. And, you know, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to try to do everything I can to talk you out of it." And he does that. And he kind of tests you to see, if this is truly what you want to do, you have to understand, because what he doesn't want to do is, he doesn't want to feel guilty or, you know, for when you do get involved and you start realizing the time commitment, what's necessary, because most people think they know what college basketball is. But quite honestly, you know, 80% of what you do is not even on the court. And he was just trying to make sure you understood, look, this isn't, you know, you're going to be involved in more of the business aspect than the X's and O's and on the court like you were in high school. Mm. And he was very, very real and honest, but I wasn't having it. I wasn't saying none of that.
You had a chance to be on a staff of a fledgling blue blood program, which is what they kind of turned out to be.
Yeah. Yes.
And then how did you end up leaving there to go to Penn State?
So I was a video intern for a year. Just again, right time, right place. We went to the Sweet 16. The associate head coach at the time, Greg Gunning, I think right around August or something like that, decided he was going to make the jump to the NBA. And they bumped everybody up. Jay Wright moved Patrick Chambers up to the associate head coach. And at that time, we were given the responsibility, Pat Chambers and I, who Pat Chambers is the baby at 12. He and I were extremely close. The first guy I met on my interview at Villanova. We never looked back. We became best friends. Jay Wright gave us the responsibility of replacing, I was moved to the operation spot of replacing the internship. And at that time we hired Kyle Neptune. Hmm. And I was the ops for 2 years. In 2009, we went to the Final Four. Patrick Chambers became the head coach at BU. I stayed with Coach Wright one more year as the ops. And then I was bumped up to an assistant. And then Patrick Chambers, after 2 years at BU, got the head coaching job at Penn State. So I met with Coach Wright, and I wanted to learn how to build a program from scratch. We had learned it at Villanova. By the time I got there, Villanova, they had just gone to the Elite Eight. We went to the Sweet 16. Then we went to the Final Four. The next year, we had the hottest start in 2010, I think, in the history of Villanova, 22-1. The program was already built, and it was already established, and we were just sustaining it. Helping sustain it. I wanted to be a head coach, and I wanted to learn how to build something from scratch. So he and I talked, and he said, "Well, there's no better opportunity to learn how to build a program than head with Coach Chambers." Big East at the height of the Big East, best Big East in history. You know, at that time, my last year in the Big East was 10 teams, I think, in the NCAA tournament. Kemba Walker's magical run. They were the ninth seed or something like that in the Big East tournament. Ended up winning the national championship. So it was the height of the Big East. And then, so I went to the Big Ten to work with Patrick Chambers. And it was just a totally different experience from a league standpoint. And then obviously, we literally had to learn. I had to learn every single facet of the business. Mm. From marketing to budget to student engagement, to alumni, to obviously X's and O's, but it was just a totally different experience. And we literally had to learn everything from scratch and build a program from scratch. Unfortunately, 6 months after we got the job, everything, the craziness at Penn State happened in 2011. And then it kind of set us back about 2 or 3 years in recruiting, but we managed to overcome.
And so your experience now, I guess all that has prepared you for what you're going through now at Fordham, where you take a bigger position. Cal Neptune brings you in as an associate head coach, but it's more of a hands-on, you know, everything. It's a, you know, Fordham is, yeah, is a mid-major in the middle of a huge city, but obviously an opportunity to use some of those skills that you learned at Penn State and Villanova to what you're doing right now.
No question. And that's the conversation that the Kyle and I had. The beauty and the genius of Kyle Neptune, in my opinion, is his humility. He knew, you know, he had left Villanova to go to Niagara with Joe Mihalik, which had already been established. He did a great job with Joe Mihalik there. They won, and he ended up going to Hofstra for a few months before going back to Villanova. But he wanted to, he knew it was important to have someone who had been through kind of a building process. And we talked openly about me coming in and kind of just understanding little things like having to get out into the student center, jump on tables, throw t-shirts out, try to start some fan engagement, along with engaging the alumni, along with fundraising, all of the things that, you know, he didn't necessarily have experience with because he didn't have to do. He went right from the internship in Villanova to an assistant position. When you skip the operations position, you don't have as much knowledge of the budget and the transportation situation and the day-to-day operations within the program, the community at large. So he knew how important that was. And that was kind of my kind of co-head coach role, as he called it. And so that's kind of how we worked together last year. He was incredibly, he gave me a lot of responsibility, and I appreciate that. And then he also brought Dave Paulson on as a consultant, an older guy who was a head coach for 27 years, to also help with us. Who was incredibly invaluable. And Kyle Neptune was so humble. He knew what he didn't know. And that was the genius, in my opinion, to him being just an effective leader.
It seems like you've got so much in terms of, you know, first of all, your hotel background probably helped prepare you for a lot of what you do. When you say, you talk about operations and budgets and just, you know, fundraising and how that the people experience there. You're the head coach, and then you've got to kind of have a philosophy of how you want to play. I mean, we haven't really even talked a lot of basketball right now. I know when Jacques Vaughn took over from the Nets, he talked about just kind of making things a little more simple. And he used the term the other day, do simple better. I know your philosophy, when I, as much as I know about it and watching your team, I feel like you embody that a little bit as well. You know, run basic stuff, but really do it well, play off each other, and then just really play hard and play with energy. And if there's a kind of a calling card, I think, of your team this year, it's that playing hard and playing with energy. And it means a lot.
There's no question. That's the beauty of Jay Wright, is it's simple. Keep it simple. There's no need to complicate it. The more coaching you do, the less connected and that your team is in our minds. And you know, it's really about the players. It's not about the, you know, the old cliche. It's not the X's and O's. It's the Jimmys and the Joes. And we use that a lot, actually, in the locker room. And the guys laugh, but it's true. You know, we believe that if we have incredibly unique and authentic relationships with our players off the court, and we don't focus as much on the court, they're willing to do things they never thought they would on the court. They're willing to literally run through a brick wall for your staff and for each other, because we spend so much time off the court with them. And then you can simplify when they're as connected, you can simplify some things on the court, because you don't need to run as much, right? So, you know, we try just to, you know, keep things as simple as possible and have really high IQ players that can feed off one another and stay connected and learn kind of more drive and space situations rather than just set plays. So you got to have really good players and really smart players and guys that love playing with each other in order to do it. But it's really about defending and rebounding and being tougher and more nasty and more together than your opponent as much as you can. And that'll carry a lot more weight than having any tricky plays or anything like that.
You talked about, you know, sustainability. That's how you sustain it. I mean, if you're trying to run, you're trying to run an elaborate, you know, intricate system. Now, if a player goes down or you don't get a certain player, then it can change. But it seems like what you're talking about becomes more sustainable for whoever you got in there running it.
There's no doubt. And if we just create, you know, and the best part about this team and the most important piece and the biggest impact I think our seniors will have on this program is the younger guys we have who are extremely talented are learning. They have examples in front of them, like Darius, like Antrell and Kyle and Khalid Moore. They're able to witness and watch and kind of not fall in line is not the right word, but, you know, they're watching these guys in their fourth and fifth years of college do things that they've never seen or never thought that these upperclassmen would do. Dive on every loose ball, take charges, you know, repeat what the coaches are saying every time, kind of echo, so to speak, you know, buy into what we call attitude and attitude club and all the little things, because these guys understand, they've been in college sports long enough to realize every team's got a leading scorer. Every team's got a leading scorer. The worst teams in sports or college basketball have a leading scorer. But what wins games is all the other little things. And to have seniors buy into that, then you have no choice but to do it as a freshman. And you know that the only way you're going to really establish yourself in the program is to follow suit, to do what these guys are doing, to play as hard as they are, to buy into the things. And obviously, when you start winning, it's a lot easier.
Yeah.
The proof's in the pudding. So if you do these things, you're going to win. You know, that took a long time at Penn State. Fortunately, we saw some of the fruits of our labor last year, and it carried on to this year. So you guys are more apt to pay attention.
And you used the term attitude. And I know Jay Wright wrote a book about, you know, your program has to have an attitude. It's funny because I did the NCAA tournament for Westwood One back in, I think it was 2015 or 2016. And I had Villanova, and I got a chance to talk to Jay, and I mentioned that, you know, he knew my radio partner on the Nets, Tim Capstraw, is an old coach. And he said, Capper used to come out to Hofstra when he was coaching there. And I said, what did you ever learn from Capper? He said, well, Capper told me our program, you got to have a program, you got to have an attitude. You know, you got to have a swagger about you. And then he wrote a book about it. Capper's still waiting for the residuals on that book. but it's like,
I'll let Jay know.
Yeah, that's a thing, right? Like, you want your program to have an attitude. And it's amazing. I think what's amazing about what you've done at Fordham, I know it goes back to last year with Kyle a little bit too, but you've been able to establish that relatively quickly there at Fordham.
Yeah, you know, we're not, Fordham University, in my opinion, is just such a special place. It's more like a Villanova. It's more like a Loyola, yeah, Chicago or Gonzaga. It's, we're not looking for the most talented players. That's different. We want guys that want to be a part of something much bigger than themselves, the community. You got a top 50 academic institution in the world. You got the greatest city in the world. The community is really special, as we're starting to see right now. We want guys that want to be a part of the entire piece to the puzzle. We don't want guys who are just going to come in and just say, I want to play basketball and that's it. You know, we're perfectly fine with those types of student athletes, but it just wouldn't work with us because we want something bigger. And as a result, we're really seeking out student athletes that want to embrace and be a part of a lot more than just the basketball games and practices. So in recruiting, that's really what we seek. And as a result, those types of guys are willing to buy into all of the other little things that we're asking them to do. It's not easy to come in and just buy into diving on the floor, buy into just doing all these little things.
And the other thing, part of it, I think, you know, there's always been, and also when it comes to recruiting, I was hoping you had a couple of recruits at the game on Saturday to see what that environment.
Well, we had one of our guys.
Yeah. You know, to see what that environment's like, because so many people say all the time, oh, when I, you know, people that don't know or haven't been in the Rose Hill gym, they'll go, well, you know, you need a better facility. You need a better, and I had this conversation with Eddie Cull a lot too. Like, it, you know, the arms race can be the place where they spend most of their time, the place, the lounge where you work out, that kind of stuff. But that gym could be such an advantage to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the environment, who wouldn't want to play in front of that environment? And then you can go play a couple games at the Garden or Barclays Center, whatever it may be, if you get to be a big program. I end it with this. I know I'm going to be aware of your time.
Before you do that, Chris, don't get too crazy. I mean, we want some upgrades in facilities. Yeah, don't be getting in close contact.
Listen, I
just tighten it up a little bit.
You
said it, the lounge, though, the lounge and the places they hang out. Let's continue to work on that. We don't want to shut that out.
Absolutely.
But you're right. Rose
Hill, that's what I mean.
Keep Rose Hill what it is.
It could be. It's like when you go to Duke. I mean, we did training camp at Duke 1 year, and the facilities they had rivaled any NBA facility there, where they practiced, where they met and all that. It was this huge thing. You would have thought you were in the NBA, and then they play in Cameron, which is this little bandbox of a place, you know?
I love it. That's exactly what we want to hear.
So before I let you go, I do this thing with all my interview subjects here at the end. You remember the Jim Valvano speech at the ESPYs, Never
of
Give
course.
Up, right? That's something that I've always meant something to me in my life. He said in his speech, to have a full life, everybody should do three things every day. Laugh, cry, think. All right? So the laugh part of it, what makes Keith Urgo laugh?
Oh, man, I scare someone on our staff. or a player. So I'm just a, you know, I hide behind walls and scare Dave Paulson. I almost give him a heart attack every day. We don't go on a road trip. Everybody knows I'm hiding behind a corner. I scare players.
You're
they're
a
coming on the bus.
Jokester.
Oh, I love it. That cracks me up. I love making people free because it just laughing is amazing. We joke around. You got to have thick skin in our program and you got to have thick skin in my family. So laughing is something we do on, maybe too much. People think we're crazy. I'm big into laughing attacks. I have a lot of them with my sister. So I'm a big into laugh. I'm pretty much a practical joke. Anything they do cracks me up, and I try to do the same.
What moves you to tears? What's something that it gets your emotions stirred up in a positive, I like to keep it in a positive way. I know. Can I say one thing? The other night, the other day, it was senior day.
Yeah.
And I know one thing, and then you can give me something else. But when Quisenberry, who's your grad student senior, 2000 point scorer, came out of the game, you had a long embrace with him. And then I saw you kind of wiping your eyes a little bit. So I know that made you emotional.
100%. The relationships to me are everything in life. I've learned a lot in my 43 years in this profession recently, in the last couple of years. Like you said, obstacles the way. My family, my relationships, those were kind of give me some tears every once in a while. You know, the other night I embraced my father after the game. I've only seen my father cry twice, once in my entire life. Last year we beat GW here in this gym in a packed house. The only time they allowed fans last year because of COVID. And at center court after the game, it was the first time my father had been in Rose Hill for any event since he left Fordham in 1962. And he was crying for the first time while we took a picture. I got really emotional. The other night, I'm walking off the court and I gave him a hug. And when you're one of nine boys and you have a connection with your pops, it's not, we don't have like, we didn't grow up like, I love you. I did, you know, hugging my parents. It wasn't like that. And not that we had it hard. We were spoiled, but there wasn't like a lovey-dovey type situation. If I told my mommy I loved her, she'd be like, get in here, kick ass.
She had a business. Statement. I mean, having 10 kids is like having a business to run.
Yeah. So when I embraced my dad, he was crying. I was crying. I'll never, ever forget that moment for the rest of my life. And I am incredibly grateful. People don't quite understand what this means to me. When I say it, it's not coach speak. When you're a part of a big family like that and you have a connection with your father, I cherish it. I will never take it for granted. And I'm incredibly grateful that my mother and father get to sit courtside right now and watch some of this. That makes me cry. Thinking about it gets me emotional.
You have what, four kids yourself?
I have four children.
How are you with your
two boys?
How are you with your kids? You talk about that relationship with your parents and having 10. How are you with your kids? Are you emotional with them?
I am. I get a little bit emotional. Like, for instance, this morning, my daughter, my 7-year-old daughter, she's my third child. She has Down syndrome and she's having surgery this morning on her ears. And that'll get me emotional, even though it's just a routine procedure. But, you know, I get a little bit more emotional than my parents did, for sure. I want my kids to see, you know, empathy. I want them to grow up with empathy. And I think it's really important.
With other families that go through that with a child with Down syndrome, what's a message you'd give them?
I mean, just understand that there's no disability that prevents anything. Quite honestly, you said obstacles in the way. There is no bad day in my daughter's. I mean, she's smiling all the time. Yeah. I think they're smarter and understand and see the world in a light that we all wish we could. And I remember just looking at her every day. She's like, she's just always happy and smiling for the most part, other than loud noises. And I just constantly remind myself, man, I wish I had her thought process. And when I walk in the door and she gives me a hug, or my other daughter gives me a hug, I'm like, ah, no matter what has happened throughout the day, that's fulfilling enough. I'm good to go.
The final part of this was the think part. I always use the term. You're going to be going into that A10 tournament at Barclays Center, and outside Barclays Center, there is an Oculus. They call it a circular video board, and it can be seen by anybody walking in or just coming out of the subway or walking around there at Flatbush and Atlantic. So many people see it. If you could put a message up on that board for people to think about, what do you think that might be?
It's a great day to be a Ram. Nah, I just, you know, I live by the golden rule. In my house, we constantly say the golden rule to my kids. I have to repeat it. Treat people the way that you want to be treated. Mm. And whatever happens after that, you know, life usually works out that way. And I think our seniors are seeing the success they're having because they're incredible people off the court, and they work really hard. And when you treat people the right way, most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, great things happen. I think the think part is probably the only thing that I don't fulfill every day of that message, but I would say try to live by the golden rule. And that's in our house, that's treat people the way you want to be treated. And most of the time, great things are going to happen to good people.
Well, let's hope there's a lot of Fordham alum and New York City basketball fans who are going to come in and make Barclays Center like the extension of Rose Thrill this week. You guys start 7:30, the quarterfinals Thursday night. Hope that they pack that gym and that Barclays Center, my home office, becomes your home office this week.
Chris, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on. You're an inspiration to a lot of people. And
thank you.
We appreciate the Barclays Center, and obviously, you know, we hope Rose Thrill transports everyone within 300 miles, you know, of the tri-state area, or even more. Come, these kids love it. It creates an incredible environment and energy. Why not turn Barclays into Rose Thrill of the South? And let's see where it takes us. We got a long road ahead of us. We got a tough team, so we're going to have to play. But I think if we stay connected and we play as hard as we possibly can, we'll have a chance to compete.
Well, as a Fordham alum, class of 92, I appreciate everything you've done for the school this year, and what Eddie Cull, your athletic director, has done. And hopefully, you compared Fordham to Villanova a little bit. Let's hope that we're still having this conversation 15 years from now with you and Eddie running things there at Fordham. Don't go anywhere.
I would absolutely love it. I think he's one of the best in the business. His relationship and his desire to do what the vision is, and the alignment between the Board of Trustees, President Tetlow, and Eddie Cull, and our basketball program has never been as tight knit and headed in the right direction as it currently is right now. I feel privileged to be a part of it during an incredible time. So I hope to be here for a long time.
Keith, go get him this week. Thanks so much for joining us and taking the time, buddy. Thank you.
So much for having me. Great day to be a Ram.
Great day to be a Ram. And once a Ram, always a Ram, as you like to say as well. Thanks, Keith. All right, my thanks to Keith Ergo. The Fordham Rams getting set to go Thursday night, 7:30 at Barclays Center in the quarterfinals. Their opponent to be determined just yet. And see if they can make a run and get to the NCAA tournament. I'm excited as a Fordham alum, and I hope everybody turns up there. Go to BarclayCenter.com or the Barclay Center box office to get your tickets, and let's pack the house for the Fordham Rams in the A-10 tournament coming up. Keith Urgo has everybody believing at Fordham. And if you aren't already watching the show Ted Lasso, you should be. Season 3 coming out very shortly. The trailer just came out. And of course, you know, Believe is the thing. Ted Lasso, you've seen that yellow sign with the blue writing, Believe. So much of what coaching is about is making your team believe. Do simple better. It's not always about scheme. It's about motivation. It's about getting the best out of your team and making them believe that they can accomplish anything. So my recommendation for what to watch is the season 3 coming up of Ted Lasso. So if you haven't already watched, go out and watch the first 2 seasons. And I was so excited that the trailer of the new season has a song from one of my, as you know, if you listen to this, one of my favorite artists, Frank Turner. He has a song called "I Still Believe," and they use that in the little trailer piece thing to season 3. Not the trailer where they show parts of the show, but this little video they did to get you excited for season 3. They used this song by Frank Turner and his Apple and Spotify streams went through the roof. So I'm so happy about that. And I'll give you a Believe song today. Could have gone with, you know, "Don't Stop Believing" by Journey, which of course used at the end of The Sopranos, kind of changed that a little bit. Got Frank Turner, "I Still Believe." Mumford & Sons has a good song, Believe. But a band that I really got into this year and an album that I loved called Lavender Days, there's a song from the band Camp, C-A-A-M-P, 2 A's, C-A-A-M-P, Camp, Believe. My song recommendation for the day. I believe in you, baby, and I'll always be around. I believe in you, baby. I won't let you hit the ground. I believe. Let's go Fordham. Let's go Rams. Let's go Nets. My thanks to our producers, Steve Goldberg, Tom Dowd, engineer Isaac Lee. Thanks to our guest, Keith Urgo. And thank you all for listening and subscribing to the Voice of the Nets. I'm Chris Carino. Talk to you next week.